Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take complex topics and really unpack them for you. Today, we're diving into a landmark case in environmental law, Sterling v. Velsicol Chemical Corp. For you, especially if you're interested in how our legal system grapples with corporate responsibility, this case offers a powerful look. It shows what happens when a company's actions devastate the environment and, well, the long fight for accountability that can follow.
That's exactly right. Think of Sterling v. Velsicol as a really crucial example, especially in the area of toxic torts. It highlights the significant hurdles individuals face when they try to seek justice against corporations for environmental damage. What's fascinating here, I think, is how the courts had to balance compensating those harmed with the, you know, strict legal requirements for proving that harm actually occurred because of the defendant's actions.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more for you. At the heart of this deep dive is Velsicol's chemical waste dumping in Tennessee. And this wasn't like a minor incident. We're talking about a massive amount of hazardous material.
Yeah.
And then the subsequent legal battle with the affected residents. To really set the scene, just consider this. Velsicol buried over 300,000 drums of chemical waste.
300,000, yeah. It's staggering. And they bought this 242-acre site back in 1964, and for nearly a decade, it just became their dumping ground. And what really stands out is the apparent lack of basic environmental safeguards. These weren't sophisticated containment facilities we're talking about. They were simply unlined trenches dug into the ground.
Right. And here's where the timeline gets really interesting for you and quite alarming. As early as 1967, the U.S. Geological Survey actually found chemicals leaching into the groundwater. Local residents started complaining, reporting that their wells were contaminated. But despite these early warning signs, Velsicol apparently continued their dumping practices until 1973. That's when the state finally stepped in and ordered them to stop.
But, you know, as you can imagine, the damage was already pretty extensive by then. It wasn't until 1978 that the full scale of the contamination became, well, undeniable. Tests confirmed the presence of dangerous toxins in the drinking water supply. For the community affected, this was really the breaking point, and it led directly to the class action lawsuit that we're focusing on in our deep dive today. What's quite telling and important to note is that the evidence presented later strongly suggested Velsicol had at least some level of awareness regarding the potential risks associated with their disposal methods.
That's such a crucial piece of the puzzle for you to understand. The district court would later determine that Velsicol actually possessed significant knowledge about the highly toxic nature of the chemicals they were putting in the ground. Their failure to implement even basic safeguards, like, you know, lining those trenches, despite this awareness, played a really vital role in the court's ultimate findings of liability. So you have the picture now. Widespread contamination, a community deeply affected, and a company that seemingly ignored clear dangers. Let's shift our focus now to the legal battlefield itself. What were the initial legal claims brought against Velsicol?
Well, the plaintiffs came at it from several angles, which is pretty common in these complex environmental cases. They alleged negligence, essentially arguing that Velsicol failed to act with reasonable care in how they disposed of the waste. They also claimed strict liability. The argument there was that the activity itself disposing of such hazardous materials in that manner was inherently and abnormally dangerous, regardless of Velsicol's specific intent or level of care. And additionally, they brought claims of trespass because the contaminants physically invaded their property, and nuisance because the contamination substantially interfered with their ability to use and enjoy their land. A whole suite of claims.
And for you, it's important to know that the initial ruling in the district court was a pretty significant victory for the residents, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The district court sided with the plaintiffs. Crucially, it agreed to certify the case as a class action, meaning it could proceed as one single lawsuit representing all the affected residents. The court found Velsicol liable under those multiple legal theories we just discussed, negligence, strict liability, and so on, and awarded millions of dollars in damages to the class. However, as often happens in these big high-stakes cases, Velsicol appealed the decision to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that appeal really zeroed in on some key aspects of the damages award and the legal reasoning behind the district court's ruling.
Right. So for you following along, what were the main legal hurdles or questions that the Sixth Circuit had to grapple with during this appeal? We know they ended up adjusting some of the damages.
Exactly. The Sixth Circuit essentially focused on three core questions. First, was it legally correct to certify this as a class action? Especially, you know, considering that individual health issues and financial losses would naturally vary across such a large group of plaintiffs. Second, did the plaintiffs adequately prove that their specific injuries were actually caused by the chemicals Velsicol dumped? This is that crucial issue of causation we mentioned earlier. And third, were the amounts awarded fair and legally justified under Tennessee law? This applied to both compensatory damages meant to cover actual losses and punitive damages meant to punish Velsicol.
Okay, let's really dig into the court's reasoning on these points for you. Starting with class certification might seem a bit counterintuitive, right? How could a case with diverse individual health outcomes proceed as one single class action? What was the legal basis for allowing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. The key legal principle here, for your understanding, is the commonality of the underlying issue. The Sixth Circuit agreed with the lower court that Velsicol's single course of conduct, their decision to dispose of waste in that specific, unsafe manner, was the central question of liability. And that central question applied to everyone in the affected area. So while the specific health problems and financial losses might differ from person to person, the fundamental question was Velsicol responsible for the contamination in the first place, was a common legal question shared by the entire class. This shared central issue allowed the case to proceed as a class action under a specific rule, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23B. This rule basically permits class actions when common legal or factual questions predominate over individual ones, even if those individual differences exist, as long as a class action is the most efficient and fair way to handle the claims.
Okay, that clarifies how a case with individual damages could still proceed as a class action for you. Now let's talk about strict liability. This is a legal concept that often comes up with dangerous substances. Why did the court find it applied to Velsicol's actions here?
Right. So under the legal doctrine of strict liability, certain activities are considered so inherently abnormally dangerous that whoever undertakes them can be held legally responsible for any harm that results. And this is true even if they weren't necessarily negligent or didn't intend to cause harm. The court in Sterling determined that disposing of highly toxic chemical waste in unlined trenches without proper containment qualified as such an abnormally dangerous activity. The inherent risks, the potential for widespread contamination, the known toxicity, were just deemed so substantial that the responsibility for any resulting harm should fall squarely on the party conducting the activity, Velsicol in this case, regardless of whether they were careless in the traditional sense.
And for you, how did Velsicol's actions also meet the criteria for the other legal theories, negligence, trespass, and nuisance? Briefly.
Sure. Well, for negligence, the court found Velsicol failed to exercise reasonable care, the care a prudent company should have taken, especially given their knowledge about the chemical's toxicity and the potential harm. The lack of basic precautions was key. Trespass applies because the chemicals physically invaded the plaintiff's property without permission. Simple as that, really. And finally, nuisance was supported because the contamination caused a substantial and unreasonable interference with the plaintiff's ability to use and enjoy their own land. So yeah, Velsicol's actions hit multiple legal wrongs.
Now let's get into what is often the most challenging aspect in these types of cases for you to understand, proving causation. How did the plaintiffs try to link their various health problems to Velsicol's dumping, and why were some of those claims ultimately not successful in court?
Ah, yes, causation. This brings us to that crucial legal standard in Tennessee law, reasonable medical certainty. For each individual plaintiff's claimed injury, they had to present expert medical testimony and scientific evidence. This evidence needed to establish a direct causal link between their exposure to the specific contaminants from Velsicol and their specific health issue. And importantly, that link had to be established to a reasonable medical certainty. This means the connection had to be more than just, you know, a possibility or a maybe. It needed to be a highly probable conclusion based on accepted medical science at the time. So while the presence of toxins in the water was clearly established, proving with that required degree of medical certainty that those specific toxins directly caused each specific individual's particular health problems, say, a certain type of kidney damage in one person versus liver issues in another proved to be a really significant challenge for some plaintiffs. Similarly, claims for just an increased statistical risk of getting future diseases without a current medically certain link to an existing illness were generally considered too speculative under this standard to warrant compensation. You couldn't get paid just for being more likely to get sick later.
So for you, this really highlights a major hurdle in toxic tort litigation. It's often not enough to just show exposure to something bad and that people got sick later. The legal system demands a very strong, scientifically supported connection between the two. What about the punitive damages? The district court had initially granted a substantial amount, right? What was the Sixth Circuit thinking on that part of the ruling?
Right. The punitive damages were initially set at $7.5 million. The Sixth Circuit actually affirmed the award of punitive damages in principle. They recognized that Velsicol's conduct warranted punishment beyond just compensating the victims for their actual losses. Punitive damages, as you know, are meant to punish egregious behavior and deter similar conduct in the future. To justify them, the court had to find Velsicol acted with gross negligence or a willful and reckless disregard for others' safety. Given Velsicol's apparent knowledge of the risks and their continued dumping despite warnings, the court agreed their conduct met this high legal threshold. They deserve to be punished. However, the Sixth Circuit did send the calculation of the punitive damages back to the lower court for recalculation. Their main concern was ensuring the punitive award was appropriately related to the actual harm caused. They also wanted to make sure there wasn't any double counting where the punitive award was effectively compensating for losses already covered by the individual compensatory damages. The appellate court wanted the punitive award to be fair and proportionate, even while serving its punishing purpose.
That makes sense for you to consider. The punishment needs to be significant enough to deter, but also fair relative to the actual harm. Now, there's an interesting concurring opinion from Judge Jones. He offered a slightly different perspective on that tough issue of causation. What was his argument?
Yes, Judge Jones agreed with the overall outcome, but raised a really important point about how strictly the reasonable medical certainty standard was being applied. He argued that in cases like this, where you have clear evidence of exposure to a known toxin, and then people develop health problems scientifically linked to that toxin, courts should perhaps be more willing to infer a causal relationship. He suggested maybe using rebuttable presumptions of causation in such circumstances, meaning if a plaintiff shows exposure and consistent symptoms, the burden might shift a bit to the defendant to prove the illness was not caused by their actions, rather than the plaintiff always having the full burden to prove it was. She felt maybe requiring definitive magic words from medical experts in every single instance was too high a bar. His perspective really highlights this ongoing debate within toxic tort law about the right balance, how much scientific certainty should be legally required to hold polluters accountable, especially when the science itself might still be evolving.
It really brings to the forefront for you that inherent tension, doesn't it, between protecting public health and the legal system's demanding requirements for clear, convincing proof. So as you listen to this, why does this case, decided back in the late 1980s, still matter so much today? What are the key lessons you should take away from Sterling v. Velsicol?
Well, there are several critical takeaways for you, I think. First, it powerfully shows the value of class actions for addressing widespread environmental harm, even when individual injuries vary. It proves how a common source of corporate liability can unite many plaintiffs. Second, it really underscores that significant, often difficult, hurdle of proving legal causation in toxic torts. You generally need strong expert testimony and science linking exposure to injury to that reasonable medical certainty standard. General associations often aren't enough. Third, the case highlights the potential for substantial punitive damages against companies showing gross negligence or willful disregard for safety and the environment. But as we saw, these awards are subject to careful judicial review and adjustment. And finally, on a more technical procedural note for you, the case touched on the lack of prejudgment interest on personal injury claims in Tennessee law at the time. That's a specific point future litigants in that state would need to consider.
So for you, Sterling v. Velsicol really serves as a potent reminder. It shows the long-lasting, far-reaching consequences of corporate environmental negligence, and it underscores just how complex and challenging seeking legal remedies for those harms can be. It's a case that really digs into fundamental principles, corporate responsibility, the rights of communities impacted by pollution.
Absolutely. It compels us to think, even now, about the ethical and legal duties corporations have when handling hazardous materials. And it highlights the vital, though sometimes difficult, role the legal system plays in trying to ensure accountability for environmental damage.
So, for you, the listener, as you reflect on all this, the difficulties in proving causation, the long-term impacts of environmental damage, what do you think are the ongoing responsibilities of corporations in managing hazardous waste today? How should they safeguard public health and the environment? And what role should our legal system play in ensuring accountability in these complex situations, especially when trying to strike that balance between protecting communities and, well, acknowledging the economic realities of business? It certainly gives you a lot to consider. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We'll catch you next time.
Stay curious.